Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. The reviews are in for the opera Anna Nicole, based on the life of Anna Nicole Smith, the late Playboy playmate turned reality TV star. The opera is by the very well-respected British composer Mark Anthony Turnage, and it has been a smash. The chorus there is warning Anna Nicole about some sketchy characters, and we'll be taking a walk on the wild side ourselves in the next hour on Soundcheck. Norway's Jenny Wahl is here to perform songs from her album Innocence is Kinky, which marries some haunting and beautiful music to lyrics inspired by gender stereotypes, pornography, and Paris Hilton. And New York's favorite long-dead mayor, Fiorello LaGuardia, makes an appearance on our show, sort of, using the sort of language you would never, ever have expected him to use. Now, if you haven't seen Anna Nicole the Opera, you may have to wait a while for another chance, because the New York City Opera, the company that staged it here in New York, has gone bankrupt, despite playing to rave reviews. Our own Fred Plotkin says there might have been a few sketchy characters in that story as well. All of that's coming up later, but speaking of sketchy characters...
What's funny? Oh, yeah. Humor is often linked to shared experience.
Bo Burnham is a comedian, songwriter, and actor who rose to fame via YouTube, where millions of people have watched his homemade musical comedy videos. Now, he may have gotten his start recording in his bedroom, but in the years since, he's made the jump to Comedy Central and MTV. And now, for his latest feat, he's written a book of poetry. It's called Egghead, or You Can't Survive on Ideas Alone. Bo Burnham, welcome to Soundcheck.
Hey, John. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
So, what's funny? Has your idea of what's funny changed since the 16-year-old you started posting to YouTube?
Yeah, certainly. I would assume that's changed for most people, you know. I feel like I've been lucky enough that I started so early that my act was able to evolve naturally just because I was a 16-year-old kid and then I was an 18-year-old boy man and now I'm a, I don't know, 23-year-old two parts man, one part boy maybe. I don't know. But yeah, absolutely. Like my idea of what is funny has completely changed. And again, I'm not sure what's funny and I'm not sure what is funny. You know, what even is that?
So when you've written something, I mean, I'm thinking of some of these poems in the book Egghead. When you finish a poem, do you think, I'm not sure if that's funny or not.
Yeah, is this surprising or engaging in any way? Is this doing anything new? And really, I was writing this book while I was writing this show for MTV, and I was getting like notes from the network and redoing my drafts, and I was hearing, okay, this joke needs to hit harder. We need, you know, so it was a way to break away from analyzing my writing at first, and it was just a way for me for 2 hours a day just clear my mind and try to write something that wasn't going to be
And noticed. Did you know you were writing poems, or did you think you were writing more songs?
No. I in my stand-up, I've been doing like 10 or 15 minutes of poems in my show for the last few years where I sit down, I have chimes or a triangle, and I read poems. And then the poems started stacking up, and I was like, well, I don't want to become a poet. I don't want to become like a live poet. So I just started putting them aside as right. I was writing them because they're very like therapeutic to write. And then eventually I felt like I had like 400 or 500, and I was like, well, if I cut these down, they could be – I think there is something here.
So when you started, did you want to be a comedian or did you want to be a musician or did you want to be a musical comedian?
No, I definitely wanted to be a comedian when I started. But even like it wasn't starting that was a manifestation of my wants to be a comedian because at the time YouTube, that even paradigm of like becoming a YouTube whatever didn't exist in 2006. I didn't even know what YouTube was. I was just told, hey, I heard you wrote these funny songs. You can show your brother or whoever mm-hmm. by posting them there. But yeah, I stumbled into music as a form for it. I always wanted to be a sort of stand-up like George Carlin, Steve Martin. Those were like my heroes when I was growing up.
Well, but Steve Martin, as we know, is an ace musician.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah,
and used
amazing.
The banjo as more than just a prop back in his early days.
And he's a huge influence in being so strange and theatrical and reclaiming things that were, I think, thought of as very hacky and stupid, and kind of reclaiming silly as smart.
Right.
But anyway, I got into music and I was writing these, you know, silly songs out the gate, and it felt like they were just kind of predictable turns, and I felt like my music was a bit of a crutch, and I was thinking, okay, so one day I'm going to put the music aside and I'm going to become a real comedian, you know, instead of a musical comedian. And then I discovered all these musical comedians, people like Tim Minchin, who's this Australian.
He did Matilda.
He wrote Matilda, and he's an amazing musical comedian.
Yeah.
Bill Bailey is this British comic who did a whole show, Bill Bailey's Guide to the Orchestra, and it was this musical and comic deconstruction of every part of the orchestra. And I realized that, oh, no, musical comedy isn't a lesser form of comedy. It's just a different and, I think, less explored avenue of comedy.
In this country, maybe.
Yeah, definitely.
I mean,
in
as
this
you
country.
Say, in Britain, there's a tradition of it. We're speaking with Bo Burnham, the comedian, writer, songwriter. Here's Bo in action. The song is appropriately called "Welcome to YouTube."
Because YouTube is a place for people to share their ideas. If by people you mean 13-year-old girls, and by ideas you mean how they love the Jonas Brothers, I'm just kidding. But let's be honest, that's a hefty majority. Believe me, well then you must be a noob. So welcome to YouTube, and you don't know what you're missing. Just try searching women kissing. It's YouTube, it's what this country's been needing. A generation of kids who don't waste their time reading. Am I the only one that thinks that Lisa Nova's hot? And Chris Crocker's not. No, he's hotter.
From the album also called Bo Burnham, that is Bo Burnham with Welcome to YouTube. Now, you put that out, Comedy Central put that out like 4 years ago.
Yeah, that was basically that album was all of my YouTube songs just sort of put onto a lot. And that song in particular, that Welcome to YouTube song, was a song that I performed at YouTube Live, which was this experiment that YouTube had by trying to make like an award show, like the VMAs or something. And they did it in San Francisco. And it was that's a studio version, but I wrote it just for this live thing where I just kind of got up and tried to make fun of a little. Bit of what it was.
So did you, you know, playing the piano, did you listen to, like, Billy Joel, or did you listen to Tom Hall? I mean...
No, I did love Billy Joel growing up, but again, I didn't start playing piano until I was a freshman in high school, and it was basically like, I was like, oh man, I don't play an instrument, this is kind of lame. And I picked up the piano and sort of figured it out. But I don't have a great ear for music. I know I don't have a very musical ear. That's not being humble or anything. I'm a math person, much more of a left brain person, so I think I have a good eye for patterns. I can pick up patterns in songwriting and mimic them pretty well, but I don't have a natural musical ear. I love people that do, and I wish I could. So.
Yeah. Now, you work blue from time to time.
Yeah, yeah.
Why?
I don't know.
For a left brain guy,
Well, for... In the beginning, it certainly was like an easier way to do things, you know. But as much as I am a left-brain person, I am very much in love with theater. And I think what I try to do in my live act is cover a wider spectrum than you might expect. And
right.
I think one that represents – it's like without being too self-analytical, try to embrace the spirit of what it means to be young and an idiot and think you can do anything, you know. And so this book, having the most saccharine-type rhymey – kids' poems that are just sugary sweet, and then having the most, you know, blue, perverted sort of stuff sitting simultaneously seems like an expression of my mind, you know.
The book is called Egghead, or You Can't Survive on Ideas Alone, by my guest Bo Burnham. Would you read one of these poems for us?
Yes, I would love to.
Which one are you going to do?
Can I Have a Word?
This is Bo Burnham.
Can I Have a Word? Can I have a word, please? It can be any word. Just give me a word. We can share all the rest. Just let me have one. It can be anything. I'd take canteen or avid. I'd even settle for timely. But you can't use my word, whatever it is, without asking. Because it's my word. And I'll almost always let you use it when you ask. Unless, for example, my word is wonderful and you want to use it to describe a movie I haven't seen yet or a movie I saw already and didn't care for. I really want everything. That's my first choice. Flabbergasted's a close second.
Bo Burnham from the book Egghead, or You Can't Survive on Ideas Alone. There is a kind of Shel Silverstein quality to a lot of these poems. You know,
well, I think what's fun for me is always, is like letting yourself get lost in a bit of a lyrical rabbit hole, in the sense that that poem is really just the phrase, "Can I have a word?"
Right.
Which is a very – and it's actually – the whole poem is based off a very simple turn, which is the idea instead of saying, "Can I have a word?" It's, "Can I have a word?"
Taking just, it literally.
Yeah, and then just letting – you know, kind of letting yourself go down that and follow it so far that by the end, hopefully the reader isn't even – is just completely – on board with what you're
right.
saying, you know?
Right. The thing that's sort of Shel Silversteinish about it is the combination of poetry and illustrations. By Chance Bone?
Yes.
With whom you have worked before, right?
Yeah. Me and him and I. Him and I. Yeah, it's active.
Come on, poet.
Him and I.
Figure it out.
No. See, I'm deconstructing the idea of subject and object. He and I, we acted together in this little like indie movie in Chicago, and on the last day of it, he handed me a little portrait he did of me, and I looked at it, and I was the kid's amazing. And then and I say kid, not condescendingly, I think of myself as a kid. And then when I was writing these poems, I reached out to him, and we really just seemed to click. But again, his name is Chance Bone, so I think people are going to think it's a pseudonym I made up and give me credit, which I'm happy to welcome because I think he's so much more talented than I am.
Bo Burnham is the author of Egghead, or You Can't Survive on Ideas Alone, the comedian, songwriter, writer, performing on October 31st at the Patchogue Theater out on Long Island. What do your sets look like, sound like now?
This new show is called What. I've been working on it for 3 years, and I just recorded it for a special. I'm going to hopefully release it for free in November, December. And this one I tried to just go really big and really small, that there would be like giant, bombastic, huge numbers that I sort of mixed all these backing tracks and did lights with, and then there's very small, intimate, weird stuff. So it's piano stuff, it's poetry, it's stand-up, but then there's this new element that I haven't had yet, which is these backing tracks, which I'm sometimes miming along with, I'm sometimes singing along with, I'm sometimes reacting to. You know, I did theater all my life and loved listening on stage, and I realized that I didn't get to do that anymore as a stand-up. I had to be completely active the whole time. And then in looking at other comedians, this Australian comic Sam Simmons, there are a bunch of people that have used, Rowan Atkinson sort of used old, you know, Andy Kaufman used these sort of backing tracks and old stuff. But now with, you know, a little home studio and stuff, you can really rock the place. So it's been fun. It's cool. And it totally opened up a whole new world for me on stage.
So it's probably going to sound quite different from this next clip, but the clip is on point message-wise. It's called Art is Dead, a kind of ambiguous look at the many media possibilities, intermedia, multidisciplinary things that an artist has at his or her disposal these days.
Yeah, I think so.
This is from Bo Burnham's 2010 Comedy Central album called Words, Words, Words.
Art is dead. Art is dead. Art is dead. Art is dead. Entertainers like to seem complicated, but we're not complicated. I can explain it pretty easily. Have you ever been to a birthday party for children, and one of the children won't stop screaming because he's just a little attention attractor? When he grows up to be a comic or actor, he'll be rewarded for never maturing, for never understanding or learning that every day can't be about him.
That is my guest, Bo Burnham. Art is Dead, from his 2010 Comedy Central record, Words, Words, Words. We're talking with Bo about words and music and the various ways he's combined them in his comic music videos, in his poetry, in his stand-up show. The new book's called Egghead, or You Can't Survive on Ideas Alone. And, Bo, we asked you, as we often do with our guests, for a pick three songs that you like, that mean something to you. And having just heard Art is Dead, it strikes me that the three bands you've picked, Atoms for Peace, Vampire Weekend, and Dirty Projectors, could all be called art rock.
I guess, yeah. I guess it is art rock, yeah. That might be it.
So tell me what you like about the Atoms for Peace album, Amok, the latest from them.
I think I picked that up right when it came out, almost a year ago. And
were you a Radiohead fan?
Yeah,
first?
I was a huge Radiohead fan. You know,
and this is Tom York's other band.
Yeah, yeah. And I wasn't like, and King of Limbs was growing on me, but not at the pace that I wanted it to. And then I listened to this one, and it wasn't immediately. It was nothing. It was way too minimal. And not enough was happening. But then this one did what King of Limbs I wished had done with me and it hadn't, which is just like really grew on me. And then by the end, the most subtle, what's amazing about these songs, the most subtle changes become huge moments, it feels like, musically. But he like makes it difficult and makes you work for it. And I think that's something that's so wanted in an artist.
It's Tom York from Radiohead and Flea from Red Hot Chili Peppers and the rest of the band Atoms for Peace. Atoms for Peace and the song Ingenue from their record Amok. We're speaking with the comedian, writer, and songwriter Bo Burnham and sharing his pick three with us on Soundcheck today. Vampire Weekend, they've got a new record out too.
Yeah.
You like this one?
Yeah, I really like this one. And I like Contra. I like the second one, which people weren't really digging
as
much.
Yeah.
But I liked it because I thought it was like way weirder than it needed to be. And I was thinking, oh, this is definitely a band that's going to be exciting with every release.
So I'm beginning to detect a trend here. As with Tom York, you like it when a songwriter sort of makes things a little more unusual, a little more difficult than it needs to be.
Or not necessarily difficult, you know, because I won't be able to sit through an abstract jazz album or anything.
Right, right.
You know, and especially with Vampire Weekend, this is the end of the day, it's pop rocky, so like even the difficult version of pop rock isn't the most, it's pretty palatable. But yeah, I've always liked Vampire Weekend just because, you know, I think people have inherently dismissed them because of their outlook or their, you know, and that just doesn't factor into the music or the lyrics. Even I think people reject the content of the lyrics so much, I think, often because it seems like a little uppity, a little rich, a little spoiled. But I mean, that should be, you know, it like, I see like The Great Gatsby or something in a certain way, you know, like we should be representing all walks of life, all perspectives. And I find him very articulate, very, very talented lyrically, and I think you could publish a lot of these lyrics as just poems on pages and it would totally work.
It's called Modern Vampires of the City, and the song is Step, the latest from Vampire Weekend.
Back, we're back, I used to front like Englewood, Mechanicsburg, Anchorage, and Dar es Salaam. We'll home in New York with champagne and disco, tapes from LA / San Francisco, but actually Oakland and Alameda. Berkeley with a communist reader. Mine was in tune with a boombox and Walkman. I was a horrible girl that was back then. The gloves of love, the wisdom teeth, I love what you're on about. I feel it in my bones, I feel it in my bones. I'm stronger now, I'm ready for the high, such a modest mouth. I can't do it alone, I can't do it alone.
Vampire Weekend, the song's called Step from their last album, Modern Vampires of the City. Some really neat sound design in that as well.
Yeah, harpsichords, that was cool.
Bo Burnham, the comedian, writer, and songwriter, with us on Soundcheck, sharing his pick three. His new book is called Egghead, or You Can't Survive on Ideas Alone. really wonderful tome of poetry and illustrations. I love the Sasquatch poem. It's so kind of sad. This monster is sitting in the forest holding a bunch of flowers, and he knows she's not coming.
Yeah.
All right, Bo, so one more in your pick three.
This is the Dirty Projectors. Which is a band I've only just started getting into, so I don't know much about them or their catalog. But the song is Gun Has No Trigger, right? That's the title. I want to get that title wrong. And I don't know. I just immediately, my friend, actually the illustrator of this book recommended them to me.
So Chance Bone.
Yeah, Chance Bone. And they're great. I mean, they're like using like weird time signatures and really like, I always love slightly theatrical singing as well and literal lyrical storytelling, and the voices blending together is really dramatic and theatrical.
The vocal harmonies, the women's vocal harmonies here, you don't even notice there are no electric guitars until like your fifth time through the song. It's like, wait, there's no guitars here.
Yeah, it's amazing.
All right, so we'll hear a little bit from Dirty Projectors to wrap things up. Bo Burnham's been my guest on Soundcheck. Bo, this has been a lot of fun. Thanks
very
much. Yeah,
thank you for having me. Thank you so much.
You'd see the ocean swell and the mountains shook. You'd see a million colors if you really looked. Now quick the night draws near.
Up next, New York City Opera announced this week that it is filing for bankruptcy and effectively closing its doors. We'll get a reflection from Fred Plotkin of WQXR's OperaVore blog. And later, the Norwegian singer-songwriter and artist Jenny Wahl. She'll perform songs from a new album called Innocence is Kinky. This is Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. That's a bit from the recent New York City Opera production of Anna Nicole at the Brooklyn Academy of Music. It raised a few eyebrows last month, as any opera about the late supermodel Anna Nicole Smith should. But as fate would have it, Anna Nicole could be the swan song of New York City Opera. The 70-year-old company announced this week that it will dissolve and declare Chapter 11 bankruptcy. The closing of the so-called People's Opera is the latest and perhaps final chapter in one of the city's most storied cultural institutions. Joining me to talk about New York City Opera is Fred Plotkin, writer and blogger for our classical sister station, WQXR. Fred, welcome.
Thank you. Great to be here, even under sad circumstances.
Well, now, you wrote a very nice blog post for WQXR's OperaVore blog about the demise of city opera here in New York. For people who are not OperaVores, who are not, you know, omnivorous opera fans, why does the death of city opera matter?
Because city opera, which was founded during World War II, in part by Mayor LaGuardia, was about an expression of a part of New York City that I, as a native New Yorker, hold dear, namely that art should be available for everyone. The problem is that for a long time it was taken for granted as being there. Mm-hmm. And this is the company more than any other that has sponsored, produced, and encouraged American opera. They developed many of the greatest American opera stars.
Like Beverly Sills.
Like Beverly Sills, but also many more. Mm-hmm. Samuel Raimi, Catherine Malfitano, Carol Vanesse, Frederica von Stade, Renee Fleming, Norman Traegel. I could go on and on.
I see that.
But therefore, anything where there is artistic expression that has meaning and resonance means a lot more than buying a ticket and going out for the evening.
Yeah. We're speaking with Fred Plotkin, who wrote this this article for WQXR's OperaVore blog, WQXR, our sister station here in New York. Fred, I spent one of the best nights at the opera I've ever had with City Opera, and it wasn't like one of those, oh, back in the good old days. It was very recent. It was the Christopher Alden production of Mozart's Don Giovanni. It was funny. It was genuinely sexy. It was really dark around the edges. I mean, it was a really, as I said, it was just a wonderful night of entertainment and of music, and it just makes me think, how could this have happened? I mean, the problems that have uprooted and eventually, you know, apparently killed New York City Opera were not recent, were they? I mean, they developed over a course of time.
Yes. This is a company that has produced the second most number of performances per year for decades after the Met in the United States, not just in New York City. But its budget was always fifth or sixth in size among U.S. companies. They always had to be resourceful, and they almost always were. However, a combination of having heads of boards, and not just the recent one, but going well back, who really were not suited to heading a board. One thing that a lot of people have raised to me, and I think they're right, is that City Opera this year tried to get $20 million more dollars to present its current season. Mm-hmm. And it felt like a Hail Mary, like a stopgap. But people who would give money, and there are many, started to feel that all we're doing is plugging another hole, but we don't see planfulness. We don't see the ability to envision a future.
Right.
And this is due in part to the fact that boards in the recent past were not planful, and frankly, in my view, they hired a series of chief executives, and they didn't hire the right people. They hired people with resumes, but not with qualifications.
Well, the Gerard Mortier hiring a couple of years back, in retrospect, Fred, looks to me like an absolute unmitigated disaster for all concerned.
Financially. I think that I want to underline that he's a very interesting and provocative person,
mm-hmm.
not the easiest, but you have to be edgy in art. And I remember thinking that when he was hired, soon after Peter Gelb was hired at the Met, and that Peter Gelb was trying to push the Met in new, more creative directions, whether he did or not is another program. But Mortier would make things even edgier in New York, and I thought that was a good thing. However, any arts executive has to have a realistic budget, one that can be raised, mm-hmm. and one that can be lived with. And the problem, not only for City Opera, but other institutions too, is that they are either spending more than they have or not realistically anticipating how much money they will take in ticket sales.
So when they didn't come up with the budget that he said he needed, he backed out before he ever actually took on the job. But before doing that, he did get them to agree to cancel an entire season while the New York State Theater, now the Koch Theater, was being rebuilt. And that, you know, that turned out to be a real loss of momentum for this organization.
It was. Then, in the year of being dark, in other words, of not performing at all, they took out more than $24 million from the endowment just to pay for costs. When you are not performing, it means you don't have ticket sales. Out of sight is out of mind. And basically, audiences lost their habit of going to City Opera. So that after Mr. Steele came in and he presented his first season at the New York State Theater, then the Koch Theater, City Opera only took in 40% in ticket sales.
Right. Now, that's George Steele that you're talking
about. George Steele, yes.
We're speaking with Fred Plotkin, who has written about the demise of New York City Opera on our sister station, WQXR's OperaVore blog, and he's with us on Soundcheck today. Fred, we've seen Minnesota Orchestra going through all kinds of, you know, labor disputes. Their very well-respected, highly regarded Finnish conductor, Osmo Venska, has resigned because of it. City Opera now, you know, apparently gone for good here in New York. Is there something about these older institutions running their course? Is this a matter of kind of musical Darwinism? Will we see something else in their place?
I don't think so, because look at the wonderful New York Philharmonic. They were founded in 1842. They are very vibrant artistically. I think under Alan Gilbert, they're mm-hmm. having a golden era. They have a board that, for the most part, is focused on doing the right thing for the company. They commission new works. They are edgy, but they also keep their older audience. They understand that they have many constituencies. No, I don't think it's a matter of running their course. Mm-hmm. I think it's a matter of bad management, to which I would add, a lot of people point fingers at labor, and they say that it's greedy unions, that it's labor that demands this and that. Frankly, the unions of the New York City Opera, namely the orchestra and the chorus, were not greedy. They were victims.
Yeah.
And by that, I mean the employees. So it's easy to point fingers, but in this case, it really was not labor at all.
Is this the end of City Opera?
I'd like to think not. Really and truly, I think that we need something of a groundswell. So many people have been so enriched in this city, especially in the past 12 years, even as many people struggle. And frankly, it falls to those people who have benefited to make sure that there is something that we could call popular opera arts available to other people. Because when children, I'm an example of this, I know you are too, grow up in New York City, we get education through the public schools, but also through our arts institutions. It makes us better, more giving citizens. And John, I've been on your show a lot, and mm-hmm. sometimes I always come up with something humorous to say. I don't have it this time. I think it's a very serious issue.
Fred Plotkin with us on Soundcheck. His article on WQXR's OperaVore blog is definitely worth checking out. You'll find a link to it on our website, soundcheck.org. Soundcheck listeners, what do you think? The People's Opera, New York City Opera, folding up its tent and entering Chapter 11 bankruptcy, the end of an era. What do you think about it? Leave a comment at soundcheck.org. Fred, always great to speak with you, and thanks very much.
I'll see you at the opera, John.
You're listening to Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Here in the studio today, we have the experimental art pop of Norway's Jenny Wahl. Much of her work, including her latest record, Innocence is Kinky, directly addresses politics, gender roles, and sexuality, often in frank and provocative ways. Jenny Wahl is here with her band, and they're going to play for us a song called Mephisto in the Water, live on Soundcheck.
Killer in a cold.
that is Jenny Wahl from Norway, live here in our New York studio with a song called Mephisto in the Water. You'll find it on Jenny's newest record called Innocence is Kinky. And Jenny and her band playing for us here in the Soundcheck studio today. Håvard Volden playing guitar, Hira Lasted playing the drums, and all three of them playing synthesizers as well. Jenny, welcome to Soundcheck.
Thank you.
So I understand that this album, Innocence is Kinky, actually began as a kind of installation project, right?
Well, it started originally as a silent film concert. So even before that, it's like it's kind of an album that has just been rolling and rolling and rolling for a long time. So I did a silent film concert about 2 years ago, mm-hmm. and I had to make a lot of new music because the film was so long.
This was The Passion of Joan of Arc,
yes,
the Carl
yes,
Dreyer
yes.
film.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so a lot of new music happened, and some of those themes just came up.
So there's a song on the record called René Falconetti in Orleans, which refers to... René Falconetti was the actress who played Joan in this amazing movie.
Yeah, it is amazing.
1928, it still hits you like a punch in the gut.
Yeah, it's like... Yeah.
Are you aware that there's an Oslo connection to that film?
Yeah, it was... It was lost for many years, and then it was found at a mental hospital
in Oslo.
In Oslo.
Yeah. An amazing
story. Quite a famous one, too. Yeah.
Famous hospital?
Yeah.
And it turned out that it had been a movie theater at some point in the past, and in the closet was a perfect print of what was believed to be this lost masterpiece.
Yeah, and it's amazing, isn't it, that just this film is found at a mental hospital because it's so intense. It's not something you would want to... show people.
Right. Well, also, you know, both the director, Carl Theodor von Dreyer, and René Falconetti ended up in mental institutions.
Yes. So and, of course, there are many, like, legends about how this happened and the relation to the film.
Right.
Well,
so
I
there's
wouldn't
a
know.
Lot there that you could mine for material to make songs.
Yeah.
Meet with another theme in a lot of your songs, which is sexuality, gender roles, pornography, things like that. Is there a meeting place for these two kind of streams of thought?
Oh, definitely. I think the Dreyer film is extremely modern in its way of using the gaze, because that's what you could do with, you know, with the camera. And what he did was to have this amazing lighting so you could... For the first time, actors didn't have to wear so much makeup. And so you have this incredible moment of the nude face. And this goes with his themes because he was very sort of Protestant, Christian, pietist. That was his upbringing. And so he kind of used this kind of very interrogating personal gaze, like gazing upon the personal guilt.
You almost feel like a voyeur as opposed to a viewer when you watch this movie.
Yeah.
Folks, the movie we're talking about is The Passion of Joan of Arc. It is on DVD. It's available.
It is on DVD, yeah.
With a splendid score by a New York composer named Richard Einhorn. So that kind of sense of, you know, gazing of voyeurism, was that your sort of entry, one of the points of entry for you?
Yeah, I mean, right before this silent film concert, I'd been working on a project about trash culture. So I'd been, for the first time in my life, watching a lot of reality shows.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that.
Yeah, I was too.
What is reality TV like in Norway? Is it like here?
It's a friendly version of what you have here, I guess. I mean, I watched the 16 and Pregnant and Teen Mom, Norwegian versions, and they're kind of like, there are less people arguing, less screaming, and more like, oh, I'm so happy now. I'm so grown up, even though I'm 15.
Yeah.
It's this, it's a very strange and kind of very impersonal in a way. Gaze into somebody's very private life.
Yeah.
Very guarded and very constructed.
So how did How did this all become the subject matter of your songs? You know, whether the gazing is sort of at a distance, or, you know, whether it's the real intense gaze of looking at pornography. I mean, that whole kind of sense of our culture being so visually oriented is...
Yeah, I guess it's the violence of it that connected everything. And the reason why there was a particularly violent connection was that 2 weeks before this silent film concert, there was the massacre in Oslo. And so you could kind of, after a while, like, I had to make this music, and it felt very important to not stop doing artwork at that time, even though it was crazy. And, you know, this nation in mourning, so this is like the 22nd of July, 2011. Yeah. And
this was Anders Breivik, the yeah, guy who yeah, went out on that island at the camp and yeah, shot so many people, and there were a couple of bombs he planted in the city proper.
Yeah.
After 9/11 here in New York, a lot of artists were sort of racked with this feeling of, what do I do? Mm. You know, does it even matter if I'm making art?
And, yeah.
You know.
But it always matters to be singing. Like, it's this, because it's like, I was at one point flipping between channels on TV when they just started showing regular programming again. And it was this incredibly awful and violent moment of switching channels and seeing... you know, kids from Utøya crying, mm-hmm, being interviewed on the news. And then you switch the channel and Paris Hilton is crying because someone is eliminated from Paris Hilton's BFF. And it's the same sound. Crying is crying. And then this would appear also in my music. It would be like this kind of universal violence of singing, but also this very important thing, you know, like, yeah, this very general thing of singing, the joy and mourning of singing.
And this sort of directly gets us into the next song you're going to do, called, yes, Oslo Oedipus. This this is sort of your response to the shooting in Oslo in 2011?
Well, maybe I wouldn't go that far, but it's definitely, it's maybe even more of a sonic response, I think. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
The idea of a city that's kind of shuttered its gaze. Yeah. For once, it's not looking.
Yes,
at
exactly,
a time when maybe it needs to be.
Or it needs to be singing instead.
Mm. All right, let's hear the song.
All right.
Oslo Oedipus is the name of it. It's from Jenny Vahl's latest record called Innocence is Kinky. And she and the trio are going to play it for us live here in the Soundcheck studio.
Swarming people walk through the city quietly, like friendly zombies, like a sleeping army. A secret rhythm, a sudden sticks. A slow burning flame of safety lies at the heart. You can feel it, you cannot find it. In and out between us, a thin silver trail of broken glass stitches us to the ground, reflecting us. Cut and run. The city windows covered in cardboard and wood panels. Oslo Oedipus. Oslo Oedipus. Oslo Oedipus. I am Oslo Oedipus.
That is Jenny Vahl, live in our soundcheck studio with her song Oslo Oedipus. A version of that is on her latest record, Innocence is Kinky. That's a live performance here in the soundcheck studio. Do you have you ever studied Indian singing, raga singing?
No, but I love it.
Well, the reason I ask is, you know, we've been shooting video here, so folks will see what I'm talking about when the video gets posted. But what you do with your hands when you sing reminds me of, it's a lot of the same sort of gestures that classical singers in India use.
Well, that's funny because it's just appeared here in America. So I've used my hands always with the guitar, but now that I'm playing the synthesizer, I usually have one hand free and I don't know what to do with it. So on this tour, things have started happening, and yeah, maybe it is similar.
Yeah. Mm. Jenny Vahl is my guest on Soundcheck. The new album, Innocence is Kinky, is produced by John Parrish, who has worked with a lot of other people, most notably with PJ Harvey. So what was that experience like? What did that do for the sound of this record?
I think it did a lot for the sound. He was very much a part of the band, actually, which is very brave for a producer to just go in and play and be, you know, like it's a certain vulnerability of entering that instead of being on the other side all the time. But I think the good thing about working with him and in that setting was that we could go between the, because we've played live a lot, and obviously starting as a concert, this music was meant to be live at a certain point. But then I had gone and worked on my own with the sound installation that you mentioned that mm-hmm. I did later. And to combine the two, he was brilliant, because he really could understand that, you know, these songs, as much as they are songs, the sound needs to be taken very seriously and kind of build around the lyrics. And so, yeah, just to be able to experiment that much and not think too much about pop music, actually, was amazing. And I kind of expected to be, because I've never recorded in a proper studio before, so to me it was a bit scary to go in there and think that I am recording something that's not a pop album. I think we managed to kind of use the directness and intimacy of a more like a sound piece and combine that with the intimacy and directness of a pop song. So I'm very happy with that.
The album is called Innocence is Kinky. It is the latest from the Norwegian singer and songwriter Jenny Vahl, who's been performing with her band for us here on Soundcheck today. And it's been great fun having the three of you with us. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
In a moment, we'll sample just a few of the entries we've received in our latest listener challenge called Remix the Mayor. This is Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. Now, before we go, we want to give you a quick update on our listener challenge, Remix the Mayor. And joining me here in the studio is Soundcheck executive producer Joel Meyer. Hey, Joel.
Hey, John.
So we sort of closed the book on this challenge this past weekend.
That's right. For the past month, we asked you to download clips of different New York City mayors and then chop them up or set them to music or remix them in whatever fashion you want to. And what's going to happen over the next week is we're digging into them and listening to them, and we're also going to give them to our judges, Julie Klossner and Evan Gregory of the Gregory Brothers, best known for their auto-tune the news thing. So that's coming up next week. You're going to be hearing who the winner or maybe winners are, but in the interim, the Soundcheck staff is going to highlight some of their favorite moments from the submission. So I'm here, John, to tell you about a trend that I spotted.
Well, I'm informed that here are some of these baby booties.
That'll cost you upwards of $500 million.
For a little booty. For a little booty. For a little booty.
That's an artist calling him or herself Studio G, and the name of the song is Mayors Do Their Duty.
Now, that's Fiorella LaGuardia, that voice there.
That is. That's Mayor LaGuardia. And there's something about this clip that people really latched onto. So let's hear another one. This is from The Hitmaker.
A little booty. That is too much booty. That is too much booty.
All right, so that's The Hitmaker. I begin to see the trend.
You start to hear what I'm hearing, John. I'd like to also...
What's that called?
This song is called Too Much Booty.
Of course it is.
Yeah, so a lot of our Soundcheck listeners really latched onto this Mayor LaGuardia clip because he says the word booty. And so I'd like to play, you know, one more clip for you, John. This is the one that really sealed the deal where I knew I was onto something here. This is from Mosat, and it's called Queen Booty.
All right. So Mosat is the name of this entrant in our Remix the Mayor contest.
That's right. Mosat and Mosat's track, Queen Booty.
Yes. So there is obviously a bootylicious strain to our Remix the Mayor entrance. Can we hear the original clip of Fiorella LaGuardia?
Sure. We have the technology.
Well, I'm informed that here are some of these baby shoes, these little moccasin booties, the little booties, and that there's a supply. Oh, yes, but that doesn't answer what I'm worried about. These sell for $3.50 a pair, and that is too much for the average family for a little booty.
All right, so that is former New York City Mayor Fiorella LaGuardia. I'm still not entirely sure what he's referring to there.
It's not clear if he knew what he was referring to. But I really want to encourage people out there. This has been really, really fun to dig through these entries and hear all of the creative ways that people interpreted the challenge that we laid down to you. And so they don't all deal with booties. There are many that are booty-free in case you have kids in the room or whatever. But I really encourage you, go to soundcheck.org. We have a sort of a SoundCloud embed there, and you can listen to them there.
And then our judges, Julie Klossner, the comedian and writer, and Evan Gregory from the Gregory Brothers, will pick a winner or winners. There's no prize other than the glory.
Other than bragging rights on your block.
All right, Joel Meyer, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Tomorrow on the show... Thanks to digital tools and social media, musicians have more freedom than ever. Or do they? We'll have a conversation about the endless self-promotion that independent artists must undertake on their own behalf and whether that stifles creativity. Plus, Matana Roberts, the jazz sax player and composer, continues her Coin Coin project, which explores the history of free people of color in the early United States and her own family's long and widespread American tale. That does it for today's show. See you back here tomorrow. I'm John Schaefer. This is Soundcheck.